This is Star, my sister, and one of my best friends.
Some of y'all heard this before. I did it a couple of years ago, but I'm going to recycle it. I was born December 26th, 1957, in Dallas, Texas. I was born Starlet Joy Lansford. My parents were devout, very legalistic Christians. My mother swears that God told her my name in a dream. Who am I to deny that, right? Mom and Dad always called me Starlet. That was not Star. And then when they were mad, it was Starlet Joy. Star came from siblings and friends later on. I had three older sisters. They were much older. When I was born, Shirley was 15, Jackie was 10, and Karen, who goes by Bonnie, was 8. My dad was nearly 37, and my mom was nearly 36, so I never really knew them young. I always knew them, you know, old. I've never lived anywhere except right here deep in the heart of Texas. We moved from Dallas to Waco when I was very young, like a year and a half, so I don't really remember ever living in Dallas. We lived in my granddaddy Lansford's house. He was a drunken, dirty old man. I was sexually molested by that alcoholic grandfather. He told me it was okay because he was granddaddy, and I was only about 5 years old. My most vivid memories of him are his yellow fingernails and his beer-laden breath. Jackie married a man who physically abused her severely. When I was around 6 years old, they would take me to spend the night at their house, and I always slept on a pallet in the floor. And Jackie told me that if Ray, her husband, laid down with me, it was okay. And she was my big sister, so it had to be okay, right? So I never told anybody. Then during my, after I started school, my oldest sister, who she kind of, well, you know, I know Jackie was scared of her husband. He really, really beat her. But Shirley was actually mentally challenged. So after school or when my mom was working, because my mom and dad worked around the clock. We were very poor, and they both worked around the clock. I would go to stay with my sister Shirley, and she lived in an apartment building that had these old men, and she always told me, if they want to play with you, it's okay. You know, and she was my big sister, so, you know, I assumed it had to be okay, so I never told anybody. And, you know, I never thought much about it growing up. I thought, you know, it happened, it's behind me, and it was no big deal. Of course, as I went through recovery, I realized that it really did affect me deeply because it really affected my ability to set boundaries with men based on people that I trusted telling me it was okay. Both of my parents, they weren't very educated. They both grew up in a time when picking cotton was far more important than their education. They grew up in very poor families. They both quit school before they even completed the seventh grade. And I love my parents, and I believe with all my heart they did the best they knew to do based on their upbringing and growing up without much education, and they weren't very sophisticated. And to this day, I believe they did the best they need to do, even though I had to work through resentments later as to, well, why didn't you protect me all those years? But now, my dad did later, he attended trade school, and he became a professional welder and a steel burner. My mom was a nurse's aide most of her life. She worked in a factory sewing. She took in ironing. Dad often worked two jobs, so we didn't have everything we wanted, but we did have everything we needed. Even though we were poor, they provided what we needed. But for all their efforts and their faith, we were the epitome of dysfunction. And I'm sure if you had looked up the word dysfunction in the dictionary, it would say Star's family. When I was in the first grade, we moved to Fort Worth, and I've lived in the Fort Worth area ever since, and I love Fort Worth. And there really isn't much to say about school. I was very quick and very intelligent. I learned really quickly. Not bragging, I didn't earn it. It was a gift from God, but schoolwork was really easy. I didn't really have to study or do much homework. In fact, I think it was too easy because I got really bored, and by high school, I didn't really apply myself as much as I could have, but I flew through, and I graduated from a magnet program with honors. I graduated as a junior. We were too poor for college, so I went right to work. I didn't really get to participate in a lot of the things that kids do, like football games, roller skating, cheerleading, because, as I mentioned earlier, my parents were very, very, very legalistic. And everything was worldly. And they took the verse, you can be in the world but not of the world. They took that literally, like you weren't supposed to do anything worldly at all. And everything Everything was a sin. And they believed God to be very vengeful and punishing. So everything that went wrong had to be because I did something wrong and God was punishing me. If I had a report card that wasn't straight A's, it was, well, you must not be walking with God and God's punishing you. So that was the God I grew up with, was one who was standing up there with a whip waiting to whack me on the head with it. So everything was about that, intangible something that I had done. Now, I was a competitive gymnast. Because at that time, there weren't very many schools competing in gymnastics. It was a new sport as far as being competitive in high school. So I was actually able to, sneak around to the meets because they were mostly during school hours. So my parents didn't even really know I was doing that. Earned my own money to buy my uniform, my leotards and all that good stuff. So the only extracurricular activities I was allowed to be in was choir and school musicals. Things having to do with music. And they didn't really like that because it was worldly music, but they did let me do that, which I was really grateful for because that was, singing was my gift. Again, I didn't earn it. It was a gift from God. All through elementary and junior high school, I was always made to feel different. My mom said it was because I was born to be special. But at that time in my life, I just wanted to fit in. I was a kid in school. I just wanted to fit in. And I finally did in high school. But again, it was because I was old enough to just rebel. My sisters continued to move in and out, draining my parents financially and emotionally. But it was always that way, so I thought it was normal. My dad was an old-fashioned country preacher, and I grew up being the music in his ministry. And started in singing in public when I think I was about 5 years old. My first song was I Was Born to Love the Lord. Naturally, singing was a big part of my life. Church, school, productions, you name it, I sang it. While I was performing with a band that was visiting our church, one of the band members had asked me out, and I went out with him. And I was 18 years old. That's when I learned not everyone who sings Christian music is a Christian. Because I went out on one date with him. Now, then it hadn't been categorized as anything, but today we call it date rape. I never told anyone, but, I lost what I had left of my innocence from my childhood. I lost it that night. 5 months later, I was faced with the undeniable reality that I was pregnant. The boy was gone, and this must be a punishment for something I did wrong. That's what my parents were going to say. I can hear them now. While everyone had their opinions as to what I should do with my baby, in my mind, there was only one choice. I was going to be a mom. We all know the difficulties of being a young single mother, so I don't have to spell that out. I'll just say I've never regretted my decision. I can't imagine my life without my son or his family, which brings me so much joy. And my oldest granddaughter is going to her first school dance tonight. She's 13. And that's his child. The child that I got pregnant with being raped, that is his child. So, I have no regrets. After my son was born, I joined a contemporary Christian music band. I was pursuing my dream of making Christian music my career. And, of course, that was my mom's dream for me, too. So she was willing to help out with the baby. Then I fell in love. So fast forward. I'm young, married, 2 children, living the American dream. I had a nice home with a pool, nice cars, good job, an adoring husband. What more could I want? We traveled a lot. He was a scuba instructor, and I was an assistant instructor, so we went on lots of dive trips all over the world. We took groups of people on organized trips for the dive shop where we taught, so we spent most weekends at the lake teaching classes and doing certifications. I've been and dove all over the Caribbean Ocean. With the exception of during and immediately following pregnancies, I'd really not had any weight issues, but my distorted view of myself was that I'd always been fat. My mother was always obese, so I lived in fear of being like her. So if I weighed more than 110 pounds, I was on a diet, abusing laxatives, taking diet pills from whatever quack doctor I could find to give them to me. So that was really when the amphetamine thing started, was with pills. I didn't see that as a problem. When I got too thin for the doctors, even the quack doctors wouldn't give me pills, and I would pay somebody fat to go get a prescription for me. It kept my husband attracted to me, or so I thought. And it ensured that I fit into our social circle. It was a circle who put a lot of importance on what toys we owned and how we looked. We were members of a large area Baptist church. It was his church. I was active in the music ministry, and I taught children's choir. I found it harder and harder to balance my church commitments and our life of traveling with friends and doing all the things my husband wanted to do. And I don't blame it all on him. I loved the trips to the ocean several times a year and the weekends at the lake. My first big mistake was sacrificing the spiritual for the other stuff. In retrospect, I can see that our way of life had gradually replaced our church attendance, and for me, my husband, and all the things I was doing with my family took the place of my relationship with God. I had allowed my priorities to become all out of whack. And once that family crumbled, I had a hole in me that was crying to be filled. After 17 years of marriage, my husband decided the grass was greener with a tall, skinny blonde who was 10 years younger. She was one of his scuba students. He left and married her. They're still married. And I was convinced it was because I was fat. Now, you girls will understand this. I was a size 5. Okay, I know you guys, it didn't mean anything to you, but you girls, you understand now how sick I was. I was devastated, and so was my daughter. We both thought our family was the exception to the divorce trend. We were living the American dream, or so I thought. Conversations with my son as a grown man enlightened me to the fact that my husband was not really the man I thought he was. My heart was broken, and I didn't know what to do with my life. He was the center of my life. He had become my purpose for existing. It was at this time that my daughter and I both spiraled down into addiction. We both started drinking excessively. Now, she was only 14 when she started drinking, and by the time she was a senior in high school, she was in rehab. And I still fight the guilt and shame that I set that example for her, and she followed. My son fell in love when he was 18. He got engaged. They got pregnant in spite of promising they wouldn't. And he didn't like the way I reacted to the news because I just said I was disappointed that they had not been honest with me. So he decided to move in with his dad. And he made sure to tell me, I understand why Dad had to move out because you're just impossible to live with. So a couple of weeks later, he wanted to move back in, but I didn't let him. So July 10th, 1995, they got married. It was a beautiful wedding and a very happy occasion, but another person had left me. As part of her rebellion, my daughter got involved with a 24-year-old man. And as soon as she turned 17, she left home to live with him. Like her brother, she took the opportunity to blame me because her dad left and that was why she was leaving. So I had been left again. This was about a month after my divorce was final. And that relationship ended up in abuse also for her. My first granddaughter, Caitlin, was born on January 10th, 1996. I was only 38 years old and was becoming a grandmother. Or as I'm known to my precious little jewels, Mimi. I had no idea I could adore someone as I did and still do this beautiful baby girl. I was in the delivery room when she was born. I was still reasonably sober and had not started using drugs yet. Well, other than the diet pills, because at the time I didn't consider those drugs, okay? My son and his family lived with me when she was born, so I became really attached to her. After about a year, they moved into their own apartment. It was right around the corner, but she wasn't there every day when I came home from work or in my lap so I could sing Jesus Loves You and rock her to sleep. So now I was really alone. And I know I should have turned back to my faith, looking back, for the answers, but I made all the wrong choices. They included men, alcohol, and drugs. Anything that could numb the pain and at least temporarily fill the void, because if you could snort it, smoke it, swallow it, drink it, or sleep with it, I tried it. I never used needles by the grace of God. Of course, I had a psychotherapist who once pointed out to me that everything I say I never did, I should end the sentence with yet. That was before I got completely clean. On July 23rd, 1997, my mother had a massive stroke. She lay in the hospital in a coma for about a week and a half. I was, of course, on amphetamine diet pills. I stayed drunk for a solid year after, usually to the point of blackouts. I worked nights at a bar just because I got cheap drinks. I could run a bar tab, and then I made the money to pay it working there. And plus, there was lots of men who had drugs. I had a lot of guilt over the times I could go that I didn't go to East Texas, which is where my mom lived, for family functions because I was too hungover. I even missed her last Mother's Day for that very reason. I found ways to blame myself for her death. I know now I'm not that powerful. I didn't grieve her death for many years. In 1998, I was introduced to methamphetamines by a coworker. As my addiction progressed, she led me into a life I would never have imagined for myself. It was at first a way to control my weight. So y'all kind of see a pattern. Actually, I always thought drugs was my main problem, but I think it was food and weight obsession, okay? I've come to learn that now, but I had to get clean first. At first, it was a way to control my weight. I always thought if I had been prettier, thinner, or younger, then maybe my husband wouldn't have left me. 3 years after our divorce, I was still searching for some closure, still trying to understand why. It progressed into a way to feel high, happy, and not so empty. In 1999, my son enlisted in the Army. He was stationed at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Once he and his family moved, I had loneliness like I never knew. The only bright spot was talking to my granddaughter on the phone. At first, using was just occasional, and it was for the sole purpose of staying thin. Then I started to enjoy being able to stay up for 3 days at a time and thinking I was accomplishing so much. I felt like Superwoman. I had the most beautiful flower garden at my house you could ever imagine, but most of it was planted and tended in the middle of the night. I had these big yard lights shining on my flower garden. I would be in the office at all hours, but I kept getting farther and farther behind in my work. I was allowing people to move in and out of my house. I was the only one in my group of friends who owned anything and had a good job. So they'd come into my home, they would steal from me. Even my sister, who was a heroin addict, and her boyfriend asked if they could stay with me for a while to get on their feet. They ended up sneaking out in the middle of the night with a trunk full of my tools and electronics. My son and daughter-in-law had their second daughter, Haley, July 21st, 2001. She was born at Fort Campbell, so I didn't get to be with her when she was born. By this time, I was so strung out that I had pictures of her in my email for a week before I realized they'd sent them to me. When she was just a few weeks old, they had been calling me to meet them at my daughter-in-law, and she were coming home. They wanted to come home and stay with me, and they were trying to reach me to meet them at the airport, pick them up at the airport, and they couldn't get a hold of me. So her mom actually went and picked them up, and they ended up staying with her. For the first time that they had ever needed me, I wasn't there. And I hated myself for that, but not enough to quit. I didn't have time to be the grandmother these little precious children deserved. I can look back now, and I know that God had his hand in my life even then. I put myself, my family, including my granddaughter, in danger, dealing drugs out of my home. I'd have pounds of meth at my house at many times with my granddaughter there. But my relationship with my son and his family was gradually slipping away. I eventually stopped getting up and going to work on time, not for days at all. And not calling, and I eventually lost my 23-year, very lucrative career with a large corporation. This was a hopeless time in my life. After the union meeting on this particular day in February 2002, my grievance was denied and I was to be terminated. I was told by my union to check into rehab because they couldn't terminate me while I was in rehab. I went home and decided I should use up all my drugs because I didn't want anybody else to have them. In the back of my mind, I was thinking maybe if I use enough, I'll just die and this will all be over with. So I went to Harris HEB that night to check into Springwood, but I had to go through the emergency room because it was after hours. And when the nurse was trying to take my vitals, my blood pressure was so high it was unreadable. So I went through inpatient detox and outpatient rehab at Harris Springwood in Bedford in February 2002. And I wish I could say my motives were pure, but they weren't. I was just there to try to get my job back. I had no intentions of staying clean. And when that didn't work, my drug use only got worse. As a result, I eventually lost my home, my car, and basically hit financial ruin. Trying to support my habit without an income sped my ride to the bottom. I used my 401k, which was rather large, and any other resources I could get my hands on, including a full year of severance pay. I reached a point of wanting to die. I remember those commercials on TV, 1-800 for a phone or whatever it was, where the little guy would come out and say, "What is it like not having a phone?" And then he would poof, disappear. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to just disappear. I was jealous of that little guy on the TV that could go poof and disappear. But still, the only reason I became willing to quit was because I ran completely out of money. I didn't have any money to buy drugs. God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, and I wasn't willing to turn to the only means left. This was finally my bottom. On August 1st, 2002, I went back to Springwood to an aftercare session. Some people there told me about a Narcotics Anonymous group they attended in Haltom City called the Broadway Group. For me, this was the place to start healing. I knew who God was. I knew He was powerful and could do all things. But remember, I was raised with God that was only there to punish me when I did something wrong. Well, I had done so much wrong. It was too much to even comprehend, and I didn't feel worthy of approaching God and asking for help, and I wasn't really sure that He was willing to give it to me. So I'm really thankful that God knew where I needed to start, and He put me there, which was Narcotics Anonymous. For the first year of recovery, I was in a seat at Broadway almost every night. I had a wonderful sponsor. Some of you have met her when she's come to visit. Her name is Celia. She's still my sponsor today. She was cool. She reminded me of a hippie. She had long, straight hair and wore wire-rimmed glasses. It was no surprise that she'd been a pothead. I chose her because she seemed so much at peace with herself, and that was what I wanted. I worked the 12 steps. I did everything I was told. I never asked her why. I didn't say, "Why do I have to call you every day?" She said, "Call me every day." I called her every day. She said, "Work these steps." I worked these steps. She said, "Be at group conscience." I was at group conscience. She said, "Go with us to carry a message to Springwood." I went. Whatever she said, I did it. But she had what I wanted, so I did what she told me to do. Narcotics Anonymous and working the steps taught me that I needed to have a relationship with a higher power. What it couldn't teach me was how to build that relationship with the God that I knew to be the only higher power. I was unemployed for about a year and a half total. Once I burned through my severance and 401k and everything else, I was surviving on the little money I made on the last minute sale of my home before it was foreclosed on, and unemployment pay. But it was good. I think that was God knowing what I needed because it gave me a chance to focus on recovery. But in the meantime, I was constantly looking for a job, and with about 9 months clean, I was still going to aftercare at Springwood, and I met a man who owned a company. And he took some of us out to dinner after group, and he found out I was looking for a job, and we talked a few times, and a few weeks later, I was working for his company, which doesn't exist anymore, but it gave me a job for about 4 years. It still amazes me how, if we stay a willing vessel, God uses us every day in our everyday lives. When I had about a year clean, I was invited to attend a group that met at Richland Hills Church of Christ called CASA, which is Christians Against Substance Addiction. It was Christ-centered 12-step recovery. There was not a generic higher power. After my first meeting, I called my sponsor, excited that I had found the missing piece to my recovery. I started attending the group on a regular basis, but I was still going to NA, and through that, I found my way back to God, a God who had sacrificed His Son just for me and all my sin, a God who loved me unconditionally. I asked Christ into my life as a child, but I've come to realize that it was because I was expected to. This time, I did it because I wanted to. Even though I don't make as much money as what I lost, I know that God gives me today what I need today and what I need tomorrow tomorrow. It became harder and harder to continue with the NA meetings, the language, the use of generic God. It had become a very negative environment for me. Our little group that I started in Broadway had become very big, and if y'all know with any group, as the group grows, so does the dysfunction. I'm not knocking NA. It saved my life. And there are people who are having a hard time kicking the habit that need to be in some hardcore recovery, and that's where you find it. And I'll point you in that direction every time. There's not enough time to describe what a wonderfully healing experience my life in recovery has been. Christ manifests Himself in every aspect. I can honestly be grateful for my past and all the things that made me who I am. I'm filled with joy and gratitude every time I see a life changed. To see someone get it for the first time, to feel really forgiven, and to find a purpose in life. On May 6, 2004, my daughter gave birth to a beautiful baby girl, Morgan. I was back in the delivery room this time, clean and sober. At the time, my daughter had stopped using for 10 months, thank God. I'm sad to say she is not in recovery today. She does not raise her own daughter. Morgan lives with my son and his wife and their two daughters. I don't know if my daughter's clean or not. I have a lot of guilt to recover from regarding my daughter. I drank with her. I used with her. I taught her how to use better. That's my struggle to deal with still today. What I have come to realize is that I'm not powerful enough to make her use any more than I'm powerful enough to make her stay clean. She, too, made her own choices. I lost my dad November 6th of 2005. I was at his side when he died. God blessed me with seeing how happy he was to be going home. Dad had been expressionless for the 4 days that we spent by his bedside. Just before he took his last breath, he got the biggest, brightest smile on his face. And then he exhaled and he was gone. While this brought me great peace, it wasn't long before I realized I no longer had any living parents. I finally grieved the loss of my mother. It was very tough at times, but I never felt the compulsion to drink or use. This time, I turned to Christ for comfort. I also have wonderful supportive friends in recovery who were there for me anytime I needed them. Shortly before my dad's death, God had led me to Northwood Church, visiting with another friend of mine in recovery. I felt at home the first time I attended. I was there for a few months when I felt led to get involved. The natural choice for me was with the worship ministry. So I had been singing on the bridge team for about 5 or 6 months when the bridge team, the worship pastor, who's now our executive worship pastor, Jordan Fowler, left a message on my machine. I was going to a singles retreat. Actually, it was funny because Randy Miller, who was in charge of the singles, was telling me, well, there's a T-Life class tomorrow, Star. Don't you think it's about time you join the church? And then I got home. I had a message on my machine from Jordan. Star, I noticed you haven't been through T-Life and joined the church yet. So I guess God was telling me to join the church. It was announced in that class that Celebrate Recovery was coming to Northwood. I believe this is why God led me to Northwood. For the first time in my life, I chose a church based on what I felt led in my heart, not in my parents' church, and it was not my husband's church. As the time approached to begin and put the pieces into place for the CR ministry to materialize, an announcement was made during the service to speak to David Lowe if you were interested in participating. He happened to be sitting right across the aisle from me, so after service, I went and introduced myself. I met Mark Weston that same day, who had since come to Northwood to be the pastoral care pastor and the CR pastor. A short time later, I met with David to visit about my recovery experience and just to get to know each other. God revealed to us very quickly that he had a plan for Dave and I to work in this ministry. Mark has a spirit that can make anyone feel at ease, so thus my involvement with CR began. It has certainly been a growing experience for me. It was a little different approach to the 12 steps than the other times I had worked them. I had worked them biblically before through the CASA step guide, but CR is structured just a little different, so I learned a new way. It's given me the chance to put my two passions together, worshiping and recovering. What I love about CR is that it isn't about the drugs or the alcohol. It isn't about the codependency, and it isn't about the porn, and it isn't about the sexual addictions. It brings people together with all kinds of symptoms, people who are angry, people who are depressed, and they don't know why. It teaches us to look at what we all have in common, how we all have the same hurts and the same brokenness that brought us to this place, not at the symptoms, but at the cause. It never ceases to amaze me how God can take the bad choices we make and the worst consequences we pay and turn them into a ministry. I believe with all my heart that through Christ, the desire to drink or use drugs has been completely removed. I also know that I'm supposed to use my experience to help others who struggle with compulsive obsessive behavior of any kind to numb pain or fill a void. There are so many people in church every week who are in pain. They don't feel like they can go in their home teams or their small groups and speak out. And now God's given us a place. That's what Celebrate Recovery is for. I'm so grateful that God uses CR to bring recovery to the church. As we grow through these 12 steps, we realize that we're all children of God, and he has a path, a plan, and a purpose for us all. Isaiah 4:22 says, I have blotted your transgression like a cloud and your sins like a mist. Praise God that no matter where we came from or where we have been, no matter what symptoms manifested from our brokenness, God does not see sin in degrees. He loves us all unconditionally. His grace is sufficient. So I want to leave you with my favorite mantra, which I borrowed from Joyce Meyer. I'm not where I want to be, but thank God, I'm not where I used to be.